This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. And it's the Department of Health that's in the news today for a variety of reasons. First up, we have surgery waiting times could be cut with specialist hubs. Isabel, this feeds into a problem that you've written about, both for the Spectator and in your iColumn, when it comes to some of the hangover from the pandemic. Can you talk to us about it?
So there's a huge backlog of elective surgery and other forms of treatment of people waiting as a result of particularly the first lockdown, where NHS services were refocused almost entirely on COVID. You know, anaesthetists were diverted from the operating theatre to intensive care. And even during the following waves, treatment has obviously progressed at a much slower rate, or not at all in some cases, than normal. And it's worth pointing out that there were already rises in not just the number of people on waiting lists, but also the amount of time that they were waiting. So this was a problem before the pandemic the government wasn't getting to grips with, but it has obviously been, you know, inflated enormously by COVID. And so the Royal College of Surgeons have been proposing that there should be a network of hospital sites, of surgical hubs, to help tackle this backlog. And this is just one of the suggestions that's being bandied around by different groups within the medical world. Some hospitals want extra funding to create new sort of temporary operating theatres within their existing sites. And I think if you speak to anyone from the sort of the provider side of things, they are worried that they're just not getting the support and the funding that they need to be able to work through this massive backlog. And there's, you know, we'll go on to the politics of this in a bit. There's a big political debate about who to treat first as well. Do you go for the politically eye-catching long waiters, people who've been waiting for more than a year? And there's more than 436,000 people who've been waiting for more than a year, which is up from just 1,600 before the COVID crisis, which shows the scale of the impact of COVID on operations and treatment. But actually, that's not necessarily, according to waiting list experts, the best group of people to tackle first. So there's a lot of politics and a lot of big decisions that are yet to be made on this.
And James, where do you think the government is leaning?
One of the most difficult political decisions for the government is going to be how to deal with these backlogs in health and education. I think that Boris Johnson's instinct will be to kind of chuck money at the problem, hope that that helps solve it. But there is always a question about how much money can solve this problem, you know, how much can it absorb it. And I think one of the other things is, you know, as we move further away from this crisis, people will begin to say, well, oh my word, look at all the kind of legacies left behind of the lockdowns. And I think that will be problematic. I mean, I wonder how many years it will be before we go back to kind of normal exams, if you see what I mean. Exams marked with no dispensation to mark the lost learning because of the pandemic. I think there is also an infrastructure question here. If you think that these kind of pandemic events are going to become more frequent because of globalization, I think there is an interesting question about whether you should build a network of fever hospitals, essentially, where you would take people in a future pandemic, which would allow normal hospitals to carry on operating. I think one of the theories as to why Germany had a relatively low death toll in the first wave of the pandemic was not only did they have their care home staff stay on site, meaning there was fewer infections in care homes, but also they had more spare hospital capacity, meaning they could bring people into hospital earlier. While as in the UK, with the NHS works with very limited spare capacity, they were having to triage far more, which is one of the factors that lies behind the UK's high death toll.
Now, staying on the Department of Health, but moving specifically to the Health Secretary, how is Matt Hancock doing at the moment, Isabel? The papers and the media coverage appears to be getting worse for him. And we saw yesterday in the press conference how it was a much more difficult reception for him than speaking in the Commons. Some quite targeted questions from journalists, even if Matt Hancock didn't give them exactly what they wanted.
Yeah, so Matt Hancock clearly had the strategy yesterday of coming out fighting, but also wanting to be able to say by the end of the day, I have spent most of today answering questions about this, to show that, you know, he has no problems with the Cummings allegations because he can just answer all the questions on those allegations. The problem with saying that is you do actually have to answer the questions to be able to make that claim. What Hancock really spent yesterday doing was talking and dodging some of the really difficult questions, particularly on the discharge of people from hospitals into care homes, where he was using a very careful formulation of language, where he talked about committing to there being testing of people leaving hospital and going into care homes, which is not what Dominic Cummings alleges that he said in conversations with people in Downing Street, including the Prime Minister, that the claim is that Hancock said that people were being tested and that he signed off this discharge plan on the basis of that, when actually, according to Hancock yesterday, there wasn't testing capacity. So he was only committing to testing people when it was possible to do so. This was also against the backdrop of the Health Secretary making the pledge that there would be 100,000 tests a day by the end of April 2020, which was a target that, as we now know, he only really met by changing some of the ways in which these tests were counted and measured. And so it was very difficult for him to answer the question fully from journalists. And indeed, the way that the Downing Street press conference was set up yesterday looked a bit shifty, I have to say. Journalists weren't allowed follow-ups. It was obviously over Zoom rather than in person, so they couldn't
Matt
say.
Matt Hancock used to love follow-up questions.
He used to, apparently he loves answering questions, but only one question from each journalist. The problem is, obviously, is that even if you don't have each individual journalist saying, with respect, Health Secretary, you haven't answered my question, you just go to the next journalist and they start to operate like a pack, as they did yesterday. And so what had started off as being a reasonably, you know, good day for Hancock, in that he didn't get a drubbing in the Commons. He didn't have Conservative colleagues standing up saying, you know, answers need to be, you know, we need answers on this. I think it's so far only Daniel Poulter who's really given anything critical at all, and that wasn't in the Commons. The day started well for him, but it ended really badly, and it meant that the front pages were hastily rewritten, so that actually he was on the front page of many of the newspapers dodging questions. My suspicion is that even if he is safe in any forthcoming reshuffle and so on, we'll just get this attrition of authority from him that means it's very difficult, as we've said before, for him to pilot through these big NHS reforms that he wants to get through, that will give us more Matt Hancock, as one of our writers, Andy Cowper, has been writing on Coffee House this week. And it's difficult for a health secretary to say, I want more power anyway, but for a health secretary whose credibility and authority has been undermined so recently, to say that is going to be very difficult.
James, as Isabel touches on, it's clear that the Tory party and also the government wants to form a protective shield around Matt Hancock. But what could happen that would mean this changes, or despite the fact that Tory MPs for now do seem to want to back him, it gets harder for him to hold his position?
I think the biggest danger to him is that Dominic Cummings produces the kind of evidence that backs up the claims he made in his select committee appearance. I think if he doesn't, I mean, this kind of probably waits for the public inquiry. Presumably, there must have been minutes taken of this meeting in the cabinet room, which will reveal what precisely he said, whose recollection is correct, Hancock or Cummings is. And I mean, that is problematic for him. I think there's also an interesting question, which is, you know, to again, what was the NHS policy in terms of people going into care homes? I think there are lots of reports at the time of hospitals essentially just discharging untested elderly patients and basically taking them to care homes and saying, we're leaving them here with you because we need every bed we've got, because this fear of a repeat of the Lombardy situation happening. So I think Matt Hancock is basically everything for him. He remembers up in front of this Hunt Clark Select Committee of Inquiry. in 10 days' time now or so. And I think, essentially, if when he turns up there, Dominic Cummings has produced the evidence, then I think he's then I think that will be a very, very difficult session for him. I think if he has not, then I think Matt Hancock will go on the kind of, well, he said that, I said this, we'll have to wait for the public inquiry to settle it. Well, obviously, I would add that, you know, we do have to wait for the public inquiry to settle it, because one presumes that somewhere in number 10 there is a minute taken of these meetings which would reveal who said what.
Now, finally, news developing on the situation in Belarus. Russia has denied entry to two European airlines because they plan to avoid flying over Belarus to get to Moscow. Isabel, what should we read from this?
Well, this is the sort of escalation that you expect when countries in the West stand up to Russia after Russia has been involved to whatever extent in a certain, you know, in an incident, in an incursion, and so on. We saw it after, for instance, the Salisbury poisonings, where the Russian embassy was threatening that, you know, every action has an opposite effect, an opposite action, and this is always the risk that people cite when talking about responding to bad behaviour, frankly, from Russia, that it will escalate and escalate and escalate into some kind of hot war as opposed to tensions. But I think we're still quite a long way off it being a hot war at the moment.
I think one of the other interesting questions is, what is Putin's ultimate end game when it comes to Belarus? There was a frisson of excitement among Russia watchers earlier this year when they thought that Putin might be about to announce a political union between Russia and Belarus. And one argument you hear from some people is, look, you should be careful on how much you sanction Belarus, how much you separate it off, because if you do that, that might make Lukashenko basically say, right, let's sign up for full political union with Russia, a big expansion in the territory of the Russian state. I personally, though, think this is you can actually see a kind of parallel between this and the whole issue of whether coronavirus leaked out of a laboratory in Wuhan, right? Which is that the Western world needs to start decoupling itself, I think, from the autocratic world. If basically Belarus, as Putin is trying to ensure it does, gets away with forcing down this airliner, you know, how certain can you be that any flight over Russian airspace isn't going to be forced down so that Putin can pull off someone on that flight who he disagrees with? And I think this is such a profound challenge to the whatever phrase you want to use, Western world or free or democratic world, which is how do you deal with these autocratic states in Russia and China and their proxies, which are more interlinked into the global system than the Soviet Union ever was during the Cold War? And I think this is one of, you know, this is perhaps the greatest challenge facing, I think, facing the democratic world right now.
Just on your point about proxies as well, there's always the debate about whether or not you push countries like Belarus or, you know, in completely different circumstances, Turkey, further into the arms of strong men like Putin by clamping down on behaviour that the West sees as being unacceptable. And, you know, it is very difficult to alienate another country to the extent that it becomes more of a proxy for Putin. But I think in the case of Belarus, it's gone much further than, for instance, countries that are sort of insecure about their position in the world, such as Turkey.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.